Life Regifted by John Lodgbury. A journey of life, death, and life again. Many people have asked about my experiences through the medical emergency I had in April 2024. Since they touch on matters of faith, I've decided to share them here. For the flow of the story, I'll mention people using just their first names, and when it's important, I'll explain who they are. Otherwise, I'll use their names without introduction. I'd been looking forward to an easy flight from Chicago to Washington, D.C., dinner with colleagues, three-day working group, all neatly planned. I'd done it many times before, but this time it wasn't to be. As we took off and started to gain altitude, suddenly there's a tearing pain in my throat. It's difficult to breathe, I think. There's something wrong with the oxygen levels. But no one else seemed worried. Maybe I should press the call button. But I didn't want to be that guy. Besides, what would I tell them? My throat is hurting? That's when I started going in and out of consciousness. Apparently, I had some kind of seizure, arms jerking around. My neighbor noticed, of course, and pressed the button. A call went out for medical professionals, and three responded. One was an ER doctor. What to do? Perhaps he's having an insulin crisis. Try giving him orange juice. Maybe it's a stroke. People moved seats so that they could minister to me throughout the flight. Nobody knew what was wrong with me at the time, but my seizures might have been a result of insufficient blood flow. They put me on oxygen, which, looking back, probably saved my brain. I only have two short patches of memory from the rest of the flight. Everything was dark. People around me were saying I'd been having seizures. No, I don't think so. I think I just need to poop. In moments like this, we can become reduced to raw biology. Now they're reassuring me that they'll get me to hospital as soon as we land. But that doesn't make sense. Why would I need hospital? I managed to say out loud, I just really need to poop. But they tell me it's not safe because we're coming into land. Things stayed dark and I couldn't see. But I have occasional moments of consciousness. It felt like I was on the edge of dreaming. The next memory is very short. I'm in the ambulance jostling along the road. Apparently I had just pooped, to the annoyance of the first responder. I remember very little of the hospital that evening. The medical reports say I was conscious but confused. But my experience was that I kept going in and out of consciousness. Perhaps I was like a drunk in a state of blackout, conscious in the moment but having no memories afterwards. I do remember being in the hospital and seeing Alyssa there. The staff are asking me, is this your daughter? I'm confused. I start to say, she's my daughter's friend. But then, even in my confusion, I realize what's probably going on. Oh, yeah, she's my daughter, I lied. I guess that from back home, Rachel must be scheming to get someone in the hospital with me. I remember the surgeon talking to me urgently. I have huge clarity of this moment. She's insistent. You have an aorta dissection. You will die from this. Maybe in 5 minutes, maybe in a week, but you will die from this. You need an operation, but it's risky. There's a 50-50 chance of surviving. Do you want to go ahead? And there was the paper. Sign here. Two separate things happened for me in that moment. First, the decision. That was easy. Definite death versus a 50-50 chance. It's a math thing. It was the other thing that surprised me, my emotional response. I found myself at peace, completely at peace. It was one of those moments where faith was solid. I'm in the arms of God. I know I'm loved, and I know I'm safe, whatever happens. If it's my time now, then it's my time now. And so it was easy to agree to the operation, even knowing it might be the end. If I was more adept with words in that moment, I would have borrowed from Jesus, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." That sums up exactly how I felt in that moment, a recognition that God was holding me already. People have asked if I felt the presence of God in that moment. I wouldn't say so, no, not in any tangible way. But the peace I felt, well, that was like an overshadowing, as if it came from elsewhere. And so I signed. Alyssa had connected with Rachel on FaceTime, and now we spoke together. We said how much we loved each other. We knew we were potentially saying goodbye. And through our tears, we took this last opportunity to declare our love. And then Alyssa, very pragmatic, said to record something for Zoe and Nate, our adult children. So I found myself saying goodbye to them. And to Zoe's two little boys. Though my words hardly did justice as to how deeply I loved them all. I'm crying as I talk about this, but it's not because I'm upset. I'm crying because it's so deep. There's a beautiful moment in the C.S. Lewis film Shadowlands where his wife talks about the grief he will feel when she dies from her cancer. And he's reluctant even to think about it and tries to steer the conversation away. But she exhorts him. The pain then, she says, is part of the happiness now. It doesn't spoil it. It makes it real. Tree blossoms are beautiful because they are fragile and transient. And so I went for the operation. Okay, let's rewind a couple of hours and tell the story from Rachel's point of view. Her experience was very different from mine. It's one set of circumstances, but seen from very different viewpoints. Rachel is just about to read a story to little Oliver. Oh, look, she says, Opa is calling. Let's see what he has to say. But the voice on the phone isn't mine. It's the first responder in the back of the ambulance with me. He probably had said who he was, but Rachel couldn't process it in the moment. And now he's asking whether I have a history of seizures. No, she says. He doesn't have a history of seizures. They tell her I'm okay, that I'm conscious, but I had a seizure on the plane. Are you taking him to a hospital? Rachel wants to know. She hears him call out, hey, where are we taking him? And then the GW Center. That means nothing to her, so she looks it up. The George Washington University Hospital. At this point, it all seems a bit odd to Rachel. She's not particularly worried. But she wants me to stay in the hospital overnight because she knows that I tend to minimize health issues. So she steps into action and starts calling people in Washington. First Alyssa, but Alyssa's not answering her phone. So then she calls others. No one answers. So she texts Alyssa, call me. As Alyssa comes out of work, she picks up her phone and sees the message. Her first thought is dread that it's something about Zoe or her boys. So it's a relief when she talks with Rachel and it seems like it's something far less serious. Rachel asks her, could you go to the hospital? I want to make sure that John stays in overnight. Oh, and pretend to be our daughter so that you'll be allowed access. Alyssa got to the hospital before I did. Then there was a 20-minute delay to find me a bed and another 20 minutes to get a CT scan and so on. And together with the flight time, 2.5 hours have passed since the first onset of symptoms. And then comes the first bit of the snippet I remember, where they asked me if she's my daughter. And it doesn't even feel like a lie to say yes. Now she has access. And Rachel connects the surgeon with Rachel over FaceTime. The surgeon tells her what has happened around my heart and emphasizes how serious it is. The ICU nurse turns to Alyssa. If you're praying people, she says, this is the time to pray. My heart itself is actually in really good shape, apparently. All the blood vessels supplying it are very clear, no clogging or anything like that. The problem is the aorta. That's the mega artery that supplies every other artery. The carotid arteries that go up to your brain come off the aorta. As to the arteries that supply your heart muscles, your kidneys, your liver, all oxygenated blood comes through your aorta. My aorta had developed a swelling over time, an aneurysm. It had blown out a lump in the side. Think of the aorta like a hose pipe that's made up of three layers, inner, secondary, and outer. And where the blowout was happening, the inner layer ripped open, which was the tearing I'd felt in my throat. And now my blood was not contained within that inner lining. It started forcing its way between the inner layer and the secondary layer, making a false channel, which was then interfering with normal blood flow. The initial tear was dangerous, but not immediately deadly. However, as the tear continued to progress, it could work its way down to my heart and the aortic valve, and I'd be dead within 5 minutes. Or if the tear worked its way to my carotid arteries, then my brain would be starved of oxygen. Again, a few minutes to death. Or if the outer layer started to tear, then blood would be pumped into my chest cavity. Again, 5 minutes. Many aorta dissection patients never make it to the emergency room, and those that do still have a high mortality rate. The surgeon started telling Rachel how dangerous the surgery is. She explained all the things that could go wrong. I could die on the table, or I could have a massive stroke. They could do a perfect surgery, but I might never wake up, or I might lose my eyes and be completely blind. Of course, hearing all this turns Rachel into a basket case. This has suddenly become the worst day of her life. Even now, hearing the story retold carries her right back into the trauma of those hours. She was in the kitchen sobbing, telling herself she needs to pull herself together. How do I tell the kids that their dad might die? Zoe was at our house, in the hot tub with her two little boys. So Rachel calls Nate first, thinking maybe it's more manageable over the phone. It isn't. After talking to Nate, she goes down and tells Zoe. Of course, everybody's crying now. They decide they have to fly out, catch the overnight flight. But Rachel can't process what she's seeing in the United app, so she reads stories to the boys while Zoe books a flight. At this point, I'm being wheeled into the surgery. The surgeon had told Rachel to expect a 6-hour surgery if it goes well, but the longer it takes, the less chance there is of a good outcome. Now they've got all evening to wait for the red eye. What do you do with that evening while waiting, unable to act? This was a very different experience from mine. I'm unconscious, of course. I'm in the surgery. The surgery itself is mind-blowing. Normally during heart surgery, you'd be connected to a heart and lung machine so that oxygenated blood keeps flowing around your body while your heart is stopped. However, when the aorta is the thing they're repairing, there's nothing they can connect the machine to. They can't keep the blood flowing. Instead, they use a technique learned from drowning victims. People who drown under the ice can sometimes survive up to half an hour with minimal brain damage, even though they're not breathing. The chilling slows the rate of damage. And that's what they did with me. They chilled my whole body down to 18 Celsius, 64 Fahrenheit, which is cold enough that all biological activity stops. As they chilled me, they measured my brain as it slowed right down until flat by. My brain had entirely ceased to function. And once my brain had stopped working, they stopped my heart and left the blood to sit stationary throughout my whole body while they did the operation. Deep hypothermic circulatory arrest. They'd already opened my rib cage, and now they worked to replace the torn part of the aortic arch. They had allowed half an hour for the repair, in the hopes of minimizing collateral damage. And they managed it within 20 minutes. Then they started the complex process of warming me up and getting the blood to flow again. As the body warms, the brain starts to operate again. And depending on what ischemic damage had occurred, there's the potential for consciousness to reemerge. But at this point, they couldn't know the extent of the damage. Even though they were hopeful, my brain had still been deprived of oxygen for a long time. Clinical death is defined as when the heart and breathing stop. But even in this state, there can still be brain activity for a few minutes. But I'd be taken far past this. My brain had also ceased to function. Not only did I have no heartbeat and no breathing, but I also had zero brain activity. I had genuinely been placed in a state of death, albeit with minimal cell decay. I was being held in the doorway of Sheol for 20 minutes. By the time Rachel and Zoe got on the overnight flight, they had heard that the surgery went as well as it could have. But again, huge unknowns. Is Dad going to be severely disabled for the rest of his life? Will that even be the rest of his life? And so Rachel said to Zoe, I don't know when we'll sleep again. We have to sleep on the flight. And so that's what they did. There was nothing they could do. And they slept from exhaustion and grief. On landing, Nate and Kelsey met them at the gate, having themselves just flown overnight from Seattle. We had lived in Washington, D.C. for a few years, so had many friends there. Rachel reached out to Rob, who picked them up from the airport and brought them to the hospital. At the ICU, Rachel didn't recognize me at first. I was so swollen, a huge black eye, tubes everywhere, connected to every kind of machine imaginable, and still unconscious, still heavily sedated. The staff said they would start waking me up in the afternoon, but that I probably wouldn't be talking until the evening, if at all. Another 6 to 7 hours to wait. There was nothing they could do for me in the moment, but being rested and ready was something they could influence. So they all left and took the opportunity to grab some extra sleep and get a shower. About 3 p.m., they came back to see me. Perhaps I will have begun the process of waking. But as they came into the room, to their great surprise, I was already awake. Hello, I said, somewhat subdued and puzzled at seeing them. Where am I? The next few weeks were intense recovery, first in the ICU, then the cardiac ward, then staying in DC. It was tough on everyone, but I was blessed to have skilled and attentive staff looking after me, and my precious family supporting me in every way. A day after the surgery, I was unable to move to find a comfortable position. And so Nate bent over and lifted his broken dad in his strong arms, placing me gently where I needed to be. And Rachel and the girls, perpetually patient, continued day after day to ease my discomforts. So many people. I'm so very grateful to them all. On the second day, the anesthetist heard I had survived, and he came to see me. He reached out and shook my hand. Having patients like you, he said, makes this tough job worthwhile. He noted that the tear was just millimeters from my carotid. And the surgeon herself came every day, repeatedly expressing surprise at how well I was progressing. Now, even though every step of my recovery has been ahead of schedule, if there's even a schedule for these kinds of things, there's still a way to go. I still tire very easily, and I'm left with deficits. My descending aorta is still divided and needs to be monitored for the rest of my life. And I have spots of ischemic damage in various parts of my brain. Some affect my vision, mini blind spots, and they affect how my brain indexes and integrates information. But they're all tiny isolated spots of damage, and I'm very hopeful that therapy and the marvel of neuroplasticity will allow almost all of the functionality to come back. I feel amazingly blessed. The outcome could so easily have been so very different. To have visited death and yet suffered so little loss. It feels miraculous, and I'm filled with gratitude. Of course, there are many more stories I could tell, but instead I'm going to pull some threads together with a few reflections. We'll start with Ecclesiastes. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. I have taken this to heart over the years, putting time and thought and prayer into dying before I die, as the Buddhists would say. Consequently, in that moment, when I faced the prospect of death, it turned out that I was okay with it. I was rather surprised that the moment had arrived so unexpectedly, but the time I had spent sitting quietly contemplating what that moment might be like helped me to be at peace. The part of me, of anyone, that is most afraid to die is the ego, the mental image we have of ourselves that is always wanting to differentiate itself from everyone else. The ego is a complex of mental processes that turn the mind in on itself and that seek to benefit the self. And in meditation, I have occasionally noticed that the ego becomes quiet, quiescent even. And in those moments, my conscious awareness changed. Things were no longer being interpreted through the usually pervasive perspective of self. When Paul talks about being led by spirit rather than by flesh, I think he's talking about this, about living in a state of conscious awareness that is untainted by the lenses of egoic processes. But that's another story. In those moments of meditation, I could see that the egoic perspectives were empty of meaning, that their loss would not be something to grieve. And I think that's what had prepared me for the day of death. I could be at peace because nothing that was important would be lost. I was able to submit completely to whatever was about to unfold. And the fact that I wasn't fighting against what was happening was perhaps critical to the successful outcome. My newsfeed recently had a series of articles about near-death experiences. They have typical clickbait headlines. I nearly died and this was my experience. Many contained classic stories of bright lights or meeting grandparents and so on. These are all quite different from my experience. My experience was that death is oblivion. I had ceased to exist. My brain had zero function, and for those 20 minutes or so, the being that identifies as John Launchbury was gone. I think this is consistent with how James describes the transitory nature of our life now. He says, "Why, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes." Our life is a mist, he says. It's here now, but then it will dissipate, and then it no longer exists. This is the original Hebrew notion that each of us is a body that is enlivened, that is given spirit, consciousness. And when that body breaks down, consciousness dissipates and being ceases. To make sense of other kinds of near-death experiences, I find it useful to ask whether the individual's brain was operating at all throughout the experience. A recent popular article describing a new study hints at how bursts of brain activity allow consciousness, perhaps highly modified, to continue even after the heart stops. Now, I have no basis for assessing how real such conscious experiences are or not. After all, even Paul didn't know whether his visions were in the body or out of the body. But I think it's different when someone is properly dead, when the brain is no longer functioning at all. My experience tells me that we should expect oblivion. It's what both Old and New Testament describe as the sleep of death. Future hope, they say, is dependent on bodily resurrection. Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. Some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. In a clear sense, I died. My life ceased to be. There's a small parallel with Lazarus. Lazarus is dead for 3 days, and John is dead for 20 minutes. In Lazarus' case, it seems a miracle was needed to undo whatever biological damage had taken place. In my case, it was a medical miracle that limited biological damage from occurring. And for both of us, it was only when processes conducive to consciousness restarted that each of us came into being again. The fleeting mist of life, to use James's language, is reconstituted. Our old life is regifted. The biblical teaching of bodily resurrection makes sense here. In the promised future resurrection, the ultimate regifting of life, a new body will be fashioned and spirit given, and once again we'll become conscious beings. When we pray, we often ask for a specific outcome from some set of circumstances, but that outcome is not necessarily what happens. About a week after my operation, the son of someone we knew had had a massive heart attack and died, leaving behind a young family. When I heard about it, I struggled with survivor guilt. Why should I live while someone else dies? But such questions may never have answers. The teacher of Ecclesiastes tells us that the outcomes of this life are unpredictable. He says, consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. This is a tough lesson. We're not in control of life's circumstances. Things will turn out the way they turn out. And there's no value in refusing to accept what has come to pass. If I'd been the one to die, then that's the reality my family would have had to face. And painful though it would have been, accepting that reality would have been the only way for them to find peace. Realizing this has affected the way that I pray. Rather than ask for specific outcomes, my prayers are more about laying my desires before God and then leaving the outcomes to him. Here's what I would want, God, and help me to be at peace with whatever unfolds. Throughout this experience, I've been overwhelmed by love from my family, from friends, from colleagues, also from our church community around the world, some of whom I've never met in person. I really appreciate all of your prayers and expressions of love. And I love the capacity our community has for such loving kindness. Long may it be so. I'm going to close with a beautiful poetic email I got from a dear friend and brother in Australia, 4 days after my life was given back to me. I'm so pleased that you're recovering. I'm so pleased that we are worried but not grieving. I'm so pleased that you have more years for love and laughter, for family and friends, for praise and prayer, for sunrises and sunsets. I am sorry that you, my fine friend, are unwell, and that days of rehabilitation and psychological impact lay ahead. You're spoken about, you're on our lips, in our hearts, and mentioned in prayers. Look forward to a time when we sit down and discuss your experience in hindsight. For now, while you're in the very thick of it, know you are loved. Abiding love.
Thanks for joining us on the Press On podcast. You've been listening to John Launchbury. For more, you can visit PressOnJournal.org.